Communications from the heart. I'd like to begin by, you know, we always look to the Sedra of the week to give us a little bit insight as a start. Akev, the portion of the week begins with Vahaya Akev Tishvun. It will be if you will listen, because you will listen, and then goes on to tell us all the wonderful things that will happen to us if we will listen to the word of the Almighty. So Rashi, one of the foremost commentaries, says, why use the word Akev? Akev is an unusual word to use. It will be because you will listen. So there are many Hebrew words that are generally used. Akev really means heal. It does mean because, but it also has this, that root word also means heal. And in Hebrew, when you use Hebrew language, there's never just it's never a coincidence when you use a word. There's always some meaning there. So Rashi comments, he says, that if you will observe those mitzvahs, that a person is dosh ba'akevav, that a person generally grinds with his heel. In other words, those mitzvahs, those commandments, those observances that people don't generally pay attention to, if you will observe those, then all these wonderful things will happen to you. And I think that this is very important, because speaking about relationships are the kind of things that we don't generally associate with a Torah perspective, with religious observance. Well, all of us imagine that religious observance has to do with ritual. So, you know, you keep a Shabbos, a Kashrus, kind of thing, but relationships, how I relate to you, that should be part of, you know, an integral part of Torah. We don't generally associate that, and especially when we talk about relationships with people who are very close to us. And here I think it's very critical what the Torah is telling us. Those things that a person generally, you know, that they're down there, you don't pay attention to them, you kind of step on them, they're not uppermost, they're not top priority, if we will observe those. And I think when we talk about our most important relationships in our life, which is a relationship between a husband and wife, and those that are immediate to us, that in fact, those are indeed the relationships that we generally have a tendency to kind of keep down there. In other words, they're not the ones that we pay that much attention to. If you would ask somebody who is most important to you in your life, we would of course say, well, of course, first and foremost is my spouse. But behaviorally, when we give a look and we talk about that more as we go along, but behaviorally, are they really uppermost on our list of concerns? Are they the ones that we give the greatest amount of attention to? Or in fact, isn't it that we always feel that those that are most close to us, are most immediate to us, they'll wait. I mean, they're here today, and you know, I'll take care of the other things. You know, that they'll be here tomorrow, they'll be here next week, they'll be here. You know, as long as I'll be here, they'll be here. And the Torah comes to bring our attention to the fact that those are the ones that we have to be mindful of first and foremost. That those relationships, those things that we have a tendency to overlook and to put on the back burner, that perhaps those are the ones that we need to take a good look at and bring them to the top of the priority list. And this especially, it's important especially at this time of the year, because we're kind of in between seasons. We just finished the period of the 3 weeks, a period of mourning in Jewish history that culminated in Tisha B'Av. And you remember, those of you who've been to class and who've studied, that as a matter of fact, we lost Tisha B'Av, commemorates the destruction of both of our temples in Jerusalem. And we're told that the last temple was destroyed as a result of Sinas Chinam, which means baseless hatred, which means that though people were observing other things, their interpersonal relationships were lacking. That those were the kind of things that they didn't pay all that much attention to. And as a result of that, the temple was destroyed. So we came through that period, and thank God we went by Shabbos Nachmu. Now we're in a time of a consolation, we're approaching the high holidays. The high holidays are also a time when, obviously, now we enter the month of Elul. The month of Elul is the month prior that ushers in the first, right after the month of Elul is Rosh Hashanah. And then we go into the other Chagim, the other holidays. And Elul, the month of Elul, has always been seen as a time to take inventory, spiritual inventory, and to kind of look at what we've done in the past year, size it up, see where we need some, you know, some improvements, and make decisions for the coming year. And here, too, it's interesting that our sages tell us the halacha is, for instance, we come on Yom Kippur, we come to shul, the holiest day of the year, we're asking the Almighty for forgiveness. So we're told that those transgressions, those things that we did that were inappropriate between ourselves and the Almighty, so those we can come in on Yom Kippur and we can say to God, you know, God, I'm really terribly sorry. I'm sorry I did what I did. And if we really are sincerely regretful, then the Almighty will forgive us. But they tell us that the interpersonal stuff, kind of things that are not between ourselves and God, but between ourselves and our fellow man, that it's not enough, that Yom Kippur is not mechaper unless there's no atonement on Yom Kippur, unless we first go to those people that we've offended and that we've wronged, and we first get their forgiveness. So if we come to shul and we beat our breast and we say, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, like they say in Yiddish, segunish tofen, unless we first go to the people that we've wronged and we rectify things with them, then we can come to the Almighty and we can say to him, you know what, God, I know that the people I've wronged are your children as well as I am, and I've kind of set things straight, and you can have nachas from us now, and you can forgive me. So in all, both the season that's passed and the season that we're now entering, in both of these seasons, uppermost on the list of things that we have to attend to is our interpersonal relationships. So let's talk about relationships. And here, this pretty much applies to all relationships. And of course, the supreme relationship is the relationship between, spousal relationship between a husband and wife. Now, relationships in our day and age are really, from a Torah perspective, our relationships are built on fundamental premises that are endangered in our society today. They're built on premises such as enabling, giving, industry, hard work, trust, partnership, that is being part of a whole rather than being in a competitive situation. And the premise, from a Jewish point of view, that time is life, in contrast to the American ethic, which is that time is money. And we'll talk about that at greater length. To begin with the first one, the notion of the premise of giving and enabling. Society today, if we look around us, and to some extent, we're not even aware of it because we kind of, like the saying goes, we drink it with our mother's milk. It's so part and parcel of what we are. The society today, everything around which the world revolves is the me, myself, and I. Looking out for number one, the idolatry of self. We live basically in a hedonistic society. The principle, the premise upon which our society is built is a pleasure principle. Really, this came into being, I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg here, but it's a consequence of having no values. When you have no values, there are no family values, relationship values, something that keeps a family together, common goals, transcendent goals, goals that go beyond myself, then what happens is I get into this hedonistic mode. And the hedonistic mode, and you've all seen it, and we've all experienced it, and unfortunately we've experienced it even with ourselves. And what happens is that we're kind of always breathing down our own necks. Like, how happy am I today? Am I happy today? Am I a little more happy than I was yesterday? Am I last month? And I'm constantly taking my temperature, my emotional temperature, to see how happy I am. The focus, the total focus of my life is myself. And what happens here is that as a result of that, nobody else, there's no trust that can be had, because everybody knows that the next person is out for themselves. It's one of the Rebbe said, everybody looks out for themselves, and I'm different than everybody else. I look out for myself. And that's really what it boils down to. And so long as I know that the person here is really looking out for themselves, how can I trust anybody when I know that there's no room for me in their life? Everything revolves around themselves. And you know, what do I stand to get out of a relationship? And how can I trust the person to give me anything at all if their focus is just themselves? Now, Rav Dessler has a wonderful explanation that I think everybody in our society can relate to. He said that in relationships, in current relationships, of course, he isn't current today, but I guess it was beginning in his time. He lived in, what was it? He was Nifa maybe 30 years ago. So he said that in today's society, there's an implicit covenant among friends, but primarily marriage partners. And that's in the secular world. That is that you the person identifies another person, and basically when they come in to forge a relationship, to come together, what they're saying is, I've identified you as the person who can give me most of what I need. So therefore, let's the covenant, this contract between us is going to read, I'm going to, and of course I know I want to get from you what I can because you can give me the most, but I know I'm smart enough to know that I can't get from you without giving also. So the covenant, the contract reads, I'll let you use me for as long as you let me use you. And really, when young people come in today and they're looking at a prospect of marriage, basically, if you listen carefully, that's what they're saying. You know, you at this moment, you're the person I think who will meet my needs. And you'll meet my needs. Of course, you know, I'll come through somewhat also, but you'll meet my needs. And I will be involved in this relationship so long as you meet my needs. And the understanding is, therefore, that as soon as you don't meet my needs, and somebody else, perhaps I will identify somebody else who will meet my needs better, then we call it quits. In contrast to that, the Jewish covenant reads totally differently. And the Jewish covenant reads, and it's based on the fact that originally, you remember that when Adam was created an androgynous being. He was created a totally self-sufficient being. He was in paradise. He was able to do everything for himself. He didn't need any other being. And yet the Almighty observed what it was that he had created. He looked at Adam, and his comment in assessing Adam was, Lo tov. Lo tov hayota adam levado. Everything else the Almighty commented, Vayara Elokim ki tov, everything was fine. But when it came to Adam, this androgynous, self-sufficient, self-reliant being, he said lo tov. And our commentaries tell us that one of the reasons that it was lo tov, that it was not good, was that the human being is created, the original Adam, and all of us who were part of Adam, we're created, and we differ from the animal from subhuman species, because we're created b'tzelem Elokim, in the image of God. And what does being created in the image of God mean? I mean, what does it mean to be created in the image of God? You know, certainly physically, you look at a person, and I mean, what does it mean? You don't see it outwardly. Being created in the image of God is that many of the attributes that the Almighty has, when he blew a neshama, when he created Adam and gave, invested within Adam his image, that he gave him some of these special attributes. And one of the special attributes that he gave Adam, that he gave Adam, was just as the Almighty is the only totally, perfectly giving being, God is the only being who gives and doesn't receive. So the Almighty, one of the major thrusts, or the way the Almighty manifests himself in our world, is in his giving. Creating us in his image means that we have, because we have a piece of that, God invested a piece of himself in us, that we have a need to give. Adam, it's true, was self-sufficient, self-reliant. He was androgynous. He didn't need a woman for sexual purposes, for any purposes. Angels broiled his steak. And the trees beckoned to him. They gave him everything of their fruit. He didn't need her, you know, Chava to be his housekeeper. But still, it was lo tov. It was not good. Why? Because Adam, while he had everything, had nobody to give to. And in having nobody to give to, he wasn't expressing his real self, his total self. Being created in the image of God meant that he had the capacity to give. And when you have the capacity to give, you have the need to give. And so long as he didn't have anybody to give to, he was not a whole being. It was low tov. It was not good. So as such, all of us have this need in order to emulate the Almighty and to give expression to this image of God that adheres in each and every one of us, we have this need to give. So in a Jewish relationship, this implicit contract would read, I'm looking for somebody to give to. I will let you give to me if you will let me give to you. That's how the Jewish contract reads, in contrast to the secular contract that we see out there. And here we come across that paradox, and this is the explanation of the paradox, that we're told that it's only in giving that you receive. It's only in giving that you receive, because it's only in giving that we're giving expression to the fullness of our total being, to that investiture of God in each and every one of us. Now, in a relationship, what's important to realize too, and you know, everybody says, and you hear this all the time, if I give and I give and I give, you know, what's going to be left of me? And of course, here we're talking about healthy giving. It does, and we're not talking about pathological stuff or the sick kind of giving for a variety of reasons. We're talking about healthy situations. Now, in healthy situations, the way we understand it too is the Torah tells us very interesting, V'yohavta l'reyecha kamocha, tells us you should love your friend as you do yourself. And it's a very interesting statement of the Almighty speaking to us. And what does it mean, really? Basically, it means that we can only love our friends if we love ourselves. Love your friend as you do yourself. And understanding very well, once we see this, that if I don't love myself, then I don't have anything to give to my friend. And this is a very basic psychological understanding, that in order for me to have any energy to give to anybody else, I first have to feel good about myself. So in a relationship, when I feel that I'm called upon to give and to give and to give, what happens when I'm giving to somebody who's close to me, what I'm really doing is by giving, I'm affirming and building up their self-worth, their self-esteem. I'm in effect telling them, you're a worthwhile human being, and that's why I'm giving to you. And in turn, if I can make the other person feel whole, then what happens is that I free up their energy so they can turn around and in turn give to me as well. So in fact, that's another way that we understand that it's in giving that you receive. It's not that I'll be giving exclusively. I give to the point where I'm able to make the other person have a sense of security, a sense of self-assurance about themselves, a sense of self-confidence, self-esteem. And once I've succeeded in doing that, that person becomes more whole. And when a person becomes whole, then they have the energy to be able to relate to others. And we see this very often. We see, you know, when you come into a hospital room, or those of you, most of us have had, unfortunately, people who've been ill. And you see that when people are sick, and it doesn't make much difference if the sickness is a physical sickness or their psyches are sick. When a person is sick, they're totally self-absorbed. You know, it hurts me here and it hurts me there, and my pain, and I need pain medicine, and I need. It's one of the symptoms of illness, is to be very, very needy. When do we see signs of health? And I've seen this so many times, when you walk into that same hospital room and that sick individual looks at you and says to you, so how are you today? You know they're on the road to recovery. Once they're able to already feel well enough that they notice that there's somebody else exists in the universe, then you know they're going to get better. And it's no less true in the world of the psyche, where a person, so long as they feel so deficient and so empty, at that point, they're totally self-absorbed. If we give to that person to the extent that we can, and we make them whole, at that point, the person, hopefully, again, if it's a normal situation, that person will be able to climb out of themselves and will be able to notice that other people exist in the world as well. And, of course, this, too, has to do with caring, giving, helping somebody. You know, when we're able to extend ourselves in that way, we're able to help a person overcome their fear of intimacy. People, when they feel so deficient, are afraid of opening themselves up, being vulnerable. In a world where so much betrayal takes place, in a world where there's no trust, where they feel that everybody's out for themselves. And once we're able to invest in this way, people begin to trust so much more. Now, as we're talking about giving, there's a very important point to understand too. When we embark on relationships, you know, in America, we've bought into this thing that, you know, you fall in love and you live happily ever after. This is the romantic ideal. And, you know, you make a choice once, you know, you have this thing. What is it? How does that song go? You know, strangers in a crowd, you know, how does it go? And I look across the room and here, you know, and that's it. And it's whatever. And then, you know, I just know we're going to love each other forever after. And that's it. And that's the end of the song. And they don't tell you what happens after that. And the assumption is that the choice took place once. I looked, lightning struck, and that was it. And in fact, we find again, from the paradigm that we use, it's the paradigm of God, when God chose to create the world, that we say in the davening every day that the Almighty is mechadesh b'chol yom tamid ma'aseh b'reishis, that every day the Almighty renews the act of creation. What we're being told here is that God didn't create the world once upon a time, but as a matter of fact, every day the Almighty renews the energies that keep the world in existence. And again, that he chooses, in other words. He chose the world once, he chose to create us, but every single day, if he wouldn't send breath into our lungs, if he wouldn't choose us every single day anew, we wouldn't be alive. So the act of choosing is something that God did not once, but every single day. Again, being created in the image of God means that we're choosing beings. But just as God chose once and then chooses every day again, that's what we're called upon to do. When it comes to relationships, it's not enough to have chosen once. You know, like sometimes you hear a couple talking and the wife or the husband, whichever, says to the other, so do you love me? And the response is, well, would I have married you if I didn't love you? Of course I love you, but that's not enough. It's not a one-shot deal. Every single day, in choosing, just as God chooses the world anew every day, we have to choose the relationship anew every day. We have to energize the relationship anew every day. So what that means is that in relationships, whether it's with a friend, whether it's a spouse, that every day we have to approach the day saying, what can I do today to indicate a choice of this relationship? What can I do? Sometimes it takes, and it doesn't mean overhauling our life. It doesn't mean these dramatic changes. But just a consciousness, just a moment of thinking about the other, the person that we're choosing. Maybe it takes a nice little note, leaving a nice little note in the lunchbox, on the pillow, calling during the day, in the middle of a busy day, and saying, you know, I don't want anything. I just want to see how you're doing. I just want to tell you that I love you very much. Or whatever, just something that shows that we've been thinking and that about the other person and that we're choosing the relationship. I tell my friends, and they kind of, I don't know how many of them relate to it, but I was in a meeting one night, and my husband was there with me, and they called him, they needed a minion, so he was called out to the next room for a few minutes to daven, and then he came back into the room, and in the room where they were davening, there was a hot water percolator, and he comes back, and he's bringing me a cup of hot water. And I can't tell you how much that cup of hot water, man, I didn't ask him for the cup of hot water. He just knows that I like to drink hot water. And he was there, he was davening. And to me, when he brought me that cup of hot water, a diamond wouldn't have been any better. What it said to me is I was there davening and I was thinking about you. And there was hot water and I know you like it, so I brought it to you. That's all it took. So it doesn't take overwhelmingly magnificent things. It's just something that just gives the message, I've been thinking about you. There was a rabbi once in Milwaukee who shared a thought with us. He said, you know, you love your baby. There was such a cute baby, it's back there. You love your baby very much. So because you love your baby very much, you want to dress the baby in beautiful little things, and they look so adorable, and they look so cute, and you think, oh, as much as I loved you before, now that you look so adorable, I love you even more. And the more I love you, now I want to make you look even cuter. So now I'm going to go and get you another little something and a little... And then I love you even more. And that's, you know, you keep the person, the individual you love, you try to make them even more beautiful. You give more and more to them. And as they become, as you give, they become more beautiful and you love them. It's just a cycle that keeps going round. I want to tell you a little story that was that happened, a Hasidic little story that's kind of neat, and it's very much on target. There was a Rebbe called the Razvedarva. Don't try to pronounce it, but anyway, trust me that he existed, the Razvedarva Rebbe. In any case, this Razvedarva Rebbe had many Hasidim, and one of his disciples, one of his Hasidim, came to him one day, kind of like around this time of the year, and said to him, Rebbe, he gave him a kvittel. You know what a kvittel was? When you had a request from a Rebbe, you used to write it down on a piece of paper, and then you used to give the Rebbe the paper, and then gave him some money to give to charity. So the chassid gives him the kvittel, and on the kvittel it says, Rebbe, I need you to pray that my wife should die. So the Rebbe says, Oy vey, is she very sick? He says, no. I mean, is she suffering? Is she in a lot of pain? No. So what's the problem? He says, I don't like her. I want her to die. So the Rebbe says, well, it's not as simple as all. I mean, this is a very unusual request. You know, it's not the usual things that Rebbe gets. You know, you get a thing, a refuah shleima, or, you know, pray for the good health or whatever. So he says, it's not so simple. But I'll tell you something. We're told in our holy books, they tell us that if you make a pledge that you don't keep, then the consequences of that are, God forbid, that the person closest to you, God forbid, dies. So he says, so I would advise you that, you know, they're going to make an appeal in shul on the high holidays. So you make a pledge and don't keep it. Okay. So he thought it was a brilliant idea. So when it comes, he was a very miserly individual. Comes Yontif and Shul, and they start, you know, trying to raise some money for the temple, for the Shul. And this fellow outbids everybody. And he's giving more, and everybody is like floored. This miserly guy, you know, donating so much money, and this stopped. And they were, you know, everybody was thrilled. So then. So he did. They came to collect after Yontif, and he says, sorry, all you guys disappear. I'm not paying the pledge. So he did what the Rebbe said. So this is Yontif, the end of the of Sukkot. Comes Hanukkah. His wife is still not even a cough, not a sneeze, nothing. Nothing's happening. So he comes back to the Rebbe, and he says, it doesn't seem to be working. So he says, you know, it's kind of like this is supposed to be a little bit, you know, of a punishment. So you're supposed to kind of feel badly by it. So I'll tell you, I'll advise you what you should do. Go out and buy your wife something really beautiful. Buy her a diamond ring. Okay, if this is going to get him where he wants to go, get rid of it, fine. Goes out and buys her a diamond ring, comes back with a diamond ring. And at first she's like looking at him, you know, what's the catch? You know, what's this, you know? And she's... Okay, she gets used to the idea, and she says, well, you know, he bought me a diamond ring. Maybe I should make him one of his favorite meals. You know, maybe do something nice for him. So she goes and she makes him a meal. So then he gets this meal, and he looks, oh, you know, goes out and he gets her another present. And she sees he's getting her another present, so she tries to think of another way, doing something the way he likes it, and does something for him. And he sees that she's being nice again, so he goes out and he buys her another little something. And they keep doing for each other. One does one thing, the other one reciprocates by doing another thing. And this goes on until it comes, like before he's approaching already the next high holidays, and this is the time that the year would be up. And all of a sudden it hits him, my gosh, it's just the time that she's going to be dying. So, and... lo and behold, I would be devastated if she died. So he goes back to the Rebbe and he says to the Rebbe, he says, I don't know when it happened, but I love my wife very much now, and I don't want her to die. So the Rebbe says, in that case, you go pay the pledge. But the point of the whole story is that once you get into this mode of giving, and giving on part of one evokes giving and a response from the other, and eventually the person you give to, you end up loving that person. You end up at least starting with liking that person, but then once you make an investment in somebody, you have a vested interest in somebody, you become attached, and that those feelings kick in. The next area that's very important is industry, hard work. And here we spoke of the fact that coming from our background, we're supposed to fall in love and live happily ever after. The concept of hard work in the relationship is unknown to our society today. It's how to communicate. And this is part of the hard work that we're called upon to do. You know, all these books that have been written now, the world at large acknowledges what the Torah knew all along. When the Torah told us that men and women were equal, that they're equal in importance, but that they're different, they're not equal in the sense of being the same, people didn't understand what we were talking about. But today you have all these books, you have Men and Women in Conversation, by Kanner you have Men Are from Mars, Women Are from Venus. So the world at large, the secular world, is recognizing already today that men and women come from different planets, that we're totally different beings. And what that means is that in order to make a relationship work, that we have to communicate. We have to help each other understand where we're coming from. What we have a tendency to do is that we project what feels good to us onto the member of the opposite gender. Something, if I operate a certain way, then that must be good for the opposite gender as well. And now all these books have come to tell us that that's absolutely not the case. I mean, one of the classic examples that this John Gray gives is that the woman who comes home after a long, hard day's work, and the husband comes home and he's tired, and she starts in on him. She says, "Oh, the boss was absolutely impossible today." He says, "Quit your job." "My mother was off the wall. Don't ever talk to her again." "My sister was impossible. Cut off all relations." You know, he has everything by a man is like, you're talking about, obviously you want a solution. They're solution-oriented. You're talking about something, like, let me tell you what you do about it. The men don't understand that for women, it's therapeutic just to talk. You know, it helps us. I don't want to cut off relations with my mom. I don't want to quit my job, but I want to tell you how miserable I am. Listen to me for a while, and I'll feel better. And men, in contrast to that, men, when they have something on their mind, and we would imagine that they'll come running to us, just like we go running to them. So in contrast, the men go, what he calls, they go into their caves. So they retreat. And if we don't understand that men and women are from different planets, we take that retreat as a rejection of ourselves. Because after all, how many times do we say that to our loved one? Like, you couldn't share it with me. You couldn't tell me about it. I would certainly tell you about it. But the fact is that they operate differently. They're just different creatures. So what that demands is, for a relationship to work, is that we need to communicate. And this is really, the Torah word for a relationship is yediyah. Yediyah means knowledge. Vayeda Odom es Chava Ishto. And Odom knew his wife Chava. It doesn't say Vayeav, he loved her. It says he knew her. Because love can only come as a result of a thorough knowledge of one another. What makes you happy? To make you happy on your terms, for you to make me happy on my terms. So it takes a thorough knowledge, and this is in every area of life. This is true moment-to-moment thing. It's true in intimacy. A husband and wife have to help each other understand what makes each other happy. You know, there are differences there as well. And help our partner, understand what drives us crazy. And we have to begin to understand, to read between the lines. But one thing we have to know is, my husband always says that when a marriage takes place, that one of the things that are not a given in a marriage is prophecy. You know, we imagine, we say, how often do we say to our spouse, if you really love me, you would know that this is what I was feeling, even though I was saying the total opposite. And I was saying I didn't want this. You should have known that that's what I really wanted. And my husband says, don't expect prophecy is not one of the givens in the marriage. So in the absence of prophecy, we have to help each other understand what it is that we need. And we have to have a patient. And then we have to also make sure that we give positive strokes for progress to reinforce positive behavior. When our spouse does come through and when they do begin to give us what we need, that instead of looking what we don't have as yet, which is a tendency that we all have, like, okay, so you did this, but, you know, there's so many things you aren't doing yet. So, you know, concentrating the things you're not doing yet, give positive strokes, reinforce good behavior. And trust and trust. Trust comes as a result of commitment. And trust is very, very hard to come by. In our world today, when we spoke of that earlier contract where it's provisional, where it's, you know, I'm going to be here, so long as you make me happy, I'll try to make you happy. And what that does is it makes us so insecure in relationships. You know, the paradigm we use is the relationship between God and Israel. In the morning when men put on the phylacteries, the tefillin, they say, "Veirastichli, I betrothed you unto me." And God says to us, "I betrothed you unto me with so many good things." How does it go? I don't say it, I don't put on tefillin. B'tzedek, b'chesed, b'mishpat, it's with righteousness, with kindness, with compassion. But it starts off first, "Veirastichli li'olam, I betrothed you unto me forever." Before anything else, let's just, the bottom line is, this is going to be a forever relationship. No matter what happens, we're committed to working on it, and of course there are exceptions to the rule. There are some instances where it can't work, but for the most part, we have to enter relationships with "V'yeirastichli li'olam, I betroth you unto me forever." This is the kind of commitment, and when a relationship is based on this kind of commitment, then we're secure in the. We can be more secure. We can trust. We can begin to trust. Today we live in this future shock society, where we live in the age of, I'm sure we'll see soon when we get to refreshments, disposable plates, disposable eatingware, disposable tablecloths, disposable, now it's disposable lenses, right? And disposable, that everything disposable. And so, of course, we bring that whole notion into relationships as well. We carry it over. Everything else is disposable. And relationships, we get the feeling like, okay, so long as it serves my purpose, fine. When eventually it will be disposable, like everything else. So we have to understand that the Jewish way is "Veirastichli li'olam." There has to be this trust. The trust can only be built on a commitment that says it's going to be a forever, by hook or crook. We have a lawyer in our community who is one of the foremost practitioners in family law in the country, and he's we're very close, and he told us that when a couple comes in to him, and he's a divorce lawyer, and they talk about their relationship, and he's a person with tremendous integrity, he won't take a case unless they've worked in counseling for a period of time. So he says to them, "So have you worked hard at this relationship? Have you?" And he says it's like he's talking a foreign language. It's like there's no understanding of what he's talking about. You know, hard work. Like, you know, it's not working. You know, there's just the magic isn't there, and whatever. There's the concept of hard work is not part of our culture. We live under this illusion, of this romantic illusion, that we're supposed to choose once and live happily ever after. The other part also that's a very painful issue is the role definition. Certainly in a marriage, when a couple come together, that it's very important to understand our roles. And today it's very, very hard, because women, in an effort to achieve the liberation that we were entitled to in many areas, equal pay for equal work done and so on, but we've entered a man's world, and we're so, what it's fostered is a competitive relationship. We work side by side with men, and husband and wife come together. And they're, instead of being there to complement each other, they're competing against each other. And it's very, very destructive. Instead of empowering each other, we destroy each other. Women aren't women. When we buy into man's world, we lose a little bit of that femininity, that feminine touch, that softness, that ability, that genius of giving that women have to even a larger dimension than men. And we don't even know that it's happening to us. I've spoken to so many women, they say subconsciously, in order to succeed in the world out there, they become tough and aggressive and assertive. And you have all these, in case you don't do it yourself, you have all these training courses to help you do it. And all that femininity is lost along the way. And what it does is that it emasculates men. And then women take a look and they look at the options they have in terms of male relationship. Here they're busy wanting to be the powerful ones, and then what they do is the men are grounded to the ground, and they turn around and they say, this isn't the kind of man I want. I want a man that's, you know, a man. So it's the whole thing is counterproductive. Instead of being a woman, and I spoke to a group this Shabbos, and they wanted to know, you know, we sat around and they were looking for spouses. So I said to them, you know, it used to be once upon a time, wasn't that women of the past were weak? You look at the bubbies. If any of you remember your bubby, he had a bubby, especially those bubbies that came across the ocean to make a new life in America. And even in Europe, they were the ones that that had the stores and that ran the businesses. And they were tough ladies. They were the ones who were really the power. But they had there was an art. There was a genius they had. And that was they could have the power, but they didn't have to let the men know it every minute. They were able to do it from kind of behind the scenes, and let men be, and, you know, daddy is the man of the house, daddy is the authority, and even though she knew that he knew it wasn't so, and she knew it wasn't so, but the illusion, whatever it was, the illusion was there, and it was something that was very necessary. It was very necessary for the psyche of a man. I have to tell you, the best example was my father of blessed memory, was this magnificent public personality, this man who was, like, the best way to describe him is when he walked in, the band played. He was an orator, he spoke for thousands of people. He was just such an unbelievable personality, and he was the public figure. Most people hardly even knew that my mother existed. She was happy to be in the home, make it all possible for him. And he always used to say to us, children, make no mistake. Listen very carefully to what your mother is saying right now, because in 3 weeks, that's going to be my opinion. That's what he always used to say to us. And she was a person, she didn't have a public persona, she didn't have any of that, but he knew, and you know what? He was right. In her own quiet way, my mother was the one, he used to look to her for impressions when he wanted to psych out the person, when he wanted to know how a situation sizes up, as brilliant a man as he was. He looked to my mother. There was such a wonderful mutual respect that existed. And this is what we're told to, and Torah tells us that a woman is supposed to be an ezer kenegdo, that a helpmeet opposite him. And all the commentaries ask the question, it's such a curious phrase, helpmeet opposite him. If you're a helpmeet, then you would imagine at his side, not opposite him. So I heard from my husband once that he said, and I don't know who he heard it from, that what's required in the relationship is that we need to be able to give each other constructive criticism. So what in a context of constructive criticism, we have to be an azer, we have to be there, a helpmeet, and because we are that much distance from our husbands, or they from us, we're in a position to see things. We have that much objectivity. A person is not a mavenam himself. Karov adam la'atma, we're told. The person is too close to himself to be objective. As much as we'd like to think that we're objective to ourselves, nobody's objective to themselves. What spouses could do for one another is in the context of supportiveness, to be able to say, and it has to be in the context of supportiveness, because all of us know how much criticism hurts when it's not in the context of supportiveness. What we're able to do for each other is to say, you're wonderful, and you're terrific, and you know how sensitive you always are. But in this situation, I think that there was a little something missing. So in that context, that's what this partnership is supposed to be about. And now, the last thing before we get to one other critical area is time. Time is a tremendously important issue. Today, all of us, we know what our days and our life looks like. It's time, nobody has any time. We're rushing around, one day chases the next, and today you have all these things that are supposed to help us, all these machines that are supposed to make life easier, and really what they've done is that they shorten the tasks, but like somebody, it's just an
We live in a time of interruption of time. It's the world of call waiting. You never get to finish a conversation. And here's the next thing. And the fax machine, this big gorilla that's hit us, it said that somebody, since we have this fax machine, Federal Express seems to us like the Pony Express. It's, you know, you can't wait. You got to have it. We got to get it this minute. And everything is so time, we have to see to it that we have to disabuse ourselves of this time is money kind of value and say more than that, time is much more than money. Time is life. And if time is life, what do I want to spend my life with? Got to spend it with those that I love the most, that I care about the most. So it's very important to work at making family relations, setting aside time. You know, I tell a lot of the chevron that I speak to, they tell me, you know, and so I work and he works, and we come home and it's dinner and it's this, and when we find we collapse in bed and we're just happy to like fall into a few hours of oblivion, you know, who has time to really to be intimate or to have any quality time together? We want to be left alone. So I said to him, you know, this is by you know, all of us understand that our those people who are important in our relation, they're most important. So what we need to do is the way we do anything else that's important to us. If I had an appointment with the President of the United States, I would write it down in my calendar, and it would be non-negotiable. And you know, if I would be somewhere else, would be I'm not going to be late for this appointment. This is very important. That's how we have to pencil in into our calendars time with those people who are important to us. Otherwise, it gets away from us, and we just don't manage it. Now, the other thing that, in conclusion, what I'd like to talk to you about briefly is an institution that we have within Torah that helps in the marriage relationship, that helps dramatically. Some of you may be familiar with it, others, to some of you it may be totally new, and to some just marginally new. The mikveh, it's called the mikveh discipline. And what that involves is that in the relationship between a husband and wife, there is a period of time when a woman is menstruating, she separates physically from her husband for a period of whatever it is, five days, 6 days, whatever it takes, and then she counts a period of 7 clean days, at the conclusion of which she immerses herself in the mikveh before resuming intimacy with her husband. And the mikveh, what's a mikveh? A mikveh is a pool of water. It's kind of really a bor, which means really a cistern of water that's gathered. It's water untouched by human hands. The way it's gathered is that there's a hole in the ceiling and the roof, and rainwater comes directly into the cistern, and it's connected to like a little swimming pool area, but because it's connected to this natural, to these natural waters, that's what makes of it a mikveh. And and the conclusion of counting these 7 clean days, a woman immerses herself in the mikveh. Now it's a wonderful institution. It's not, I have to tell you, it's not a panacea for a troubled marriage. So nobody can tell you that if you have tons of problems and that need therapy, that instead you take on this mikveh discipline and all your problems will fade away. That's not the case, but certainly for a good marriage or a potentially good marriage, it works wonders for a relationship. Number one, what happens is that it's a discipline. For 2 weeks out of the month, there's a hands-off policy. You know, it's we're not available to each other on a physical level. And that's powerful stuff in our culture today, especially because we're thrown together, men and women are thrown together in offices and everywhere in the world. We work side by side with each other. And there is, the Torah tells us, as we know human nature, Torah is very, very realistic about human nature. And it tells us that there's a natural tension that exists between the sexes. And what happens on the, you know, on any given day could be an especially a wife, a husband could have had words, they could have had a tense day or whatever, and there you walk into a situation, whether it's in the office or in business place or in whatever, wherever. And a woman is, you know, especially supportive, a woman especially, whatever, if by intention or otherwise, there's an attraction there, some lovely secretaries or whatever. So what's to keep a man, especially, I mean, even outside that, you don't even have to have excuses for it, but let's assume somebody who has a certain amount of integrity, what's to keep a man from indulging that that relationship? Or that fling rather than a relationship. Why? What's to keep him? I mean, he doesn't have the resources to do it. It's, you know, there's so many availabilities today. So many people who are desperate and lonely and who will indulge in anything that they can get. So here when we observe the mikveh discipline, what it does for us is that for 2 weeks out of the month, it really fortifies, gives us, it strengthens the spiritual muscles. The muscles that say, within this permissible relationship, for 2 weeks, hands off. And what it does, it gives us the wherewithal that afterward, outside of the relationship, that we have the ability to so to speak, deny ourselves or not to succumb to that kind of temptation. So we build these muscles. This discipline makes us stronger so that we're able to avoid situations like that outside of the marriage. And by the way, as I'm telling you, some of these are side benefits. I'm not telling you these are the reasons for observing. These are not the reasons for observing the mikveh discipline. Traditional Jews observe it because God said so. And that's really enough for us. We know that there's an infinite wisdom and he understands us better than we do ourselves, and that's why we do it. But once doing it, then these are some of the things that we've gleaned. Now, it may be that those of you who decide to observe it will get out of it something totally different, and that's fine too, because it addresses each person where they're at. But just some of the things that I've gleaned from it is this discipline. It also has the ability to restore the sanctity in sexual intimacy in a world that's turned sexual intimacy into an obscenity. Out there, what do you do when you want to curse somebody? It always has to do with sexual obscenities. That's the way the world out there. That's how they say the worst things they want to say. They use something that has to do with sexuality. By us, when you observe the mikveh discipline, it brings into it. We take something that the world out there, the Christian world, sees as a concession to the flesh. I mean, we live in a Christian world. We've absorbed Christian values. And the way that Christianity looks at sex and at sexuality is that it's, you know, unfortunately, it's, you know, you have to do this because of procreation, propagation of the species. But would that not be necessary? It would be much better to abstain. Proof of that you have, that they're holy people, priests, pope, the pope, doesn't indulge. They're too holy to indulge. A contrast to that, of course, by us as Jews, a king of Israel or a Kohen Gadol, the high priest, could not serve as such unless they were married. So from our perspective, sexuality and having a healthy, intimate relationship is a tremendous value. And the mikveh really helps hammer that point home, because what happens when a woman goes to the mikveh? Imagine in a culture such as we live, where this is a concession to the flesh and where all it's an obscenity. You walk in, a woman walks in to the mikveh, and there are these godly waters, and she immerses herself. And by the way, those people will tell you that there's something hygienic about it. By the time you come to the mikveh, you have to be totally clean. You bathe beforehand. There's nothing. It's not because our grandmothers didn't have bathtubs. This has nothing to do with hygiene. This is totally spiritual. So a woman comes and she immerses herself in a mikveh, and she recites a blessing. Can you imagine? In a world where the world at large, the Christian world, sees it as a concession to the flesh, here before a woman is about to engage the intimate relationship with her husband, she recites a blessing. What does it mean when we recite a blessing? When we recite a blessing means that we invite God into whatever we're about to do. And really, but what a woman is doing when she recites the blessing upon immersion is that she's saying, God, this relationship is supreme in my life. It's more important than anything else. And I don't want it to be devoid of your presence. So I'm extending an invitation to you to join us in the bedroom. I want you to be part of that relationship. If you can invite God into an intimate relationship, what does it say about intimacy? So if we want our selves and our children to grow up with a healthy attitude, with a Jewish attitude towards sexuality, of course sexuality we're talking about husband and wife relationship, then there's nothing more powerful than the mikveh experience. What the Talmud tells us that it also helps maintain a healthy tension in a relationship, because on a monthly basis the relationship is recharged and revisited with courtship. Because what happens is, for those 2 weeks, when physical intimacy is not in order, then what happens is as the countdown begins, there's a kind of an anticipation. And in that anticipation, you begin to court each other. You begin to get excited about each other, much like in the days when the bride and groom or fiancé and then his kala and the chusn didn't have anything to do with each other before marriage, and you kind of couldn't wait for it to happen. Much the same way, on a monthly basis, this is the excitement that we bring into the relationship. And what it does in addition to that is that, you know how sometimes you gloss over situations with a physical, you know, I don't know, is there a saying like a kiss is worth 1,000 words or something? Or something to that effect. So sometimes, not a picture, I don't know where I got that, but it's good anyways. So what happens is that if you have some issues, if you have anything between you, and it's the period of time when you can have a physical rush, so usually, you know, forget about it, here's a peck on the cheek, it's going to be all right, and you don't get into it. And these 2 weeks, when the physical relationship is not called for, then we have to open new lines of communication. Then at that point, because we can't give that peck on the cheek, or because we can't be intimate with one another, then what it calls for is sitting down and talking things through. Now let's talk about this. You know, and you're feeling this way, you're feeling unloved, you're feeling whatever. Well, I can't show you in a physical way that it's not true, so we have to talk. So it opens up new lines of communication that enhances and enriches a marriage. The another thing is also in this day of women's lib, where women are viewed as sex symbols. You know how everything is, everything they sell you comes along with a free woman. You know, here's a pack of cigarettes in the car and whatever it is. So for 2 weeks, we're not sex objects for one another, so to speak. We have to relate to one another as just as people. A woman can retreat into her own person and reinforce what she is. A man, again, looks at himself, and then when they come together, they bring stronger people, more intact people, to the relationship, because they've had, Gibran is the one that said, let there be spaces in your togetherness. And these are the spaces in our togetherness that really makes the relationship much, much stronger. And just tell you one more thing about mikveh. Mikveh is spoken about in the Torah in one context. The context is that on the holiest day of the year, on Yom Kippur, in the holiest spot in the world, in Israel, in the holiest spot on the holiest spot of the world, which is the temple, and the holiest place in the temple, which was the Holy of Holies, the holiest member of our society, the Kohen Gadol, all of these converged together when the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, entered the Kodesh, the Holy of Holies, on Yom Kippur to pray on behalf, to importune God on behalf of the welfare of the Jewish people. It was such an awesome moment that if he wasn't worthy, he didn't come out of there alive. In preparation for that awesome moment, the Kohen Gadol did one thing. He immersed himself in the mikveh. And this is the feeling that we're given by this discipline, that in preparation for that which is most important in the relationship, not one of the most important things, certainly, that which is an expression of how a husband and wife feel about each other, that in preparation for that, a woman goes to the mikveh to indicate the awesomeness of that moment and how the Torah views sexuality and intimacy between a husband and a wife. I want to just end in talking about relationships, that a few cautionary words. If there are problems in a relationship, attend to them better sooner than later, before they fester and they grow. When people come in for counseling, oftentimes you'll say, you'll hear them say, well, he needs to change a lot, or she needs to really make a lot of changes. We're always looking for the other one to change and to do the changing. And even where it's in fact, and you know, no one person owns a problem, but even if in fact one is, so to speak, more of a contributor to the problem, all of the books that are written today, all the new therapy books, talk about the fact that if we, even if, let's say sometimes the partner says, well, my partner will never go into therapy, my partner will never do this and that. So we're told, and one book that speaks about this pretty eloquently is a book called Divorce Busting. And then it's a good book for everybody to read, not the only people who are contemplating divorce. That what she talks about, it's a woman, she says that what happens is that once even one partner starts making somewhat of a change, that the dynamic in the relationship changes. And she calls on the fact that, she says, if a butterfly flutters its wings in Hong Kong, that the effect of it is felt even here in the La Jolla, to think where I am. So that it's all, what it takes is that for one person to begin to change, and the dynamic of the relationship begins to change, just a little bit like the Rasvidarva story. One person does something and then it evokes a change on part of the other one. And what we need to do is to replace hedonism with values, with spiritual verities, so that we don't have this vacuum. If you don't have spiritual values, then what enters is the hedonistic philosophy of the society around us. The only antidote to that is to go and learn, to learn about our heritage, to learn about Torah, to learn about mitzvahs, and to suffuse our lives with spirituality. And when we have that spirituality, then what's going out there, that will hold it at bay to a certain extent. And we need to redraft the covenant of the relationship to one, to being givers rather than takers. And every little act that we do in that direction makes a whole world of difference. And every little bit begins with one act. A saying that goes, and I want to end with this, is sow an act and reap a habit. Sow a habit and you reap a character. Sow a character and you reap a destiny. Thank you very much.